Good evening, everyone. This is host Terry Lynn Coop on the Blue Plate Special, and I am just having a total fangirl moment here because tonight on the menu is Jonathan Mayberry. He is a New York Times best-selling author and five-time Bram Stoker Award winner, anthology editor, comic book writer, magazine writer, playwright, you name it. As a matter of fact, we'd run out of time if I was to run through all of his credits. And so we're just going to start on out with this conversation. And I'll let anyone know, if you would like to call in and ask your question direct, the number is 347-633-9609. How are you doing tonight, Jonathan?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome to the Blue Plate Special. Some of the things that we were talking about back in the green room is a new Joe Ledger novel came out in April, correct?
Yes. Dogs of War was the ninth in the series. And one of my personal favorites, because I got to play with some topics that I've always liked, which include robotics and artificial intelligence, and had a blast writing that book, and it's getting very well received. So I'm pleased that people are responding to that series and to each new book.
You said there are nine in the series?
Yeah, that's the ninth book. It started with Patient Zero, and I've been putting out one a year. And each book is a different problem. You know, the first one dealt with genetically engineered plagues that create kind of a zombie-like effect, and then each book has a different bit of weird science. We've done drones, we've done just all sorts of things, and the latest one it was a lot of fun. The next one's going to deal with sound engineering and sound-based directed energy weapons. So I get to do fun research for these books and explore the worst kind of what-if scenarios.
One of your reviewers was talking about as the harrowing events of Kill Switch and actually called it the Lovecraftian weirdness of the previous book. What was he meaning about that, about Kill Switch?
Well, I've been a big fan of the Cthulhu mythos, which was created by pulp writer H.P. Lovecraft back in the 30s. And a couple years ago, I was at Comic-Con, and my editor was out there with me, and we were just walking around, and he said, "So what's the next Ledger book?" And as a joke, I said, "Oh, Joe Ledger meets Cthulhu. You know, Cthulhu is this ancient elder god, you know, cosmic entity." I said it as a joke, and he was like, "Yeah, okay, cool." I'm like, "Really?" So
he's like, "Give me 100,000 words on that now."
Yeah, it actually turned out to be about 150,000 words. And I had a story in mind, but I had figured it was too preposterous to pitch. But like any of these high concept stories, once you start drilling down into the science that underpins the story, it becomes a lot more plausible, and the weirder elements are kind of threaded through the real world science. So it allows the reader to kind of accept the premise and suspend disbelief. And I had a tremendous amount of fun researching and writing that book, and it was a huge hit with the fans. I thought this was the one that people were going to say, "Okay, Mayberry, you've kind of lost your marbles. You know, go have a timeout somewhere." And the book was hugely popular. Go figure.
So how do you do that? How do you take a pretty straight up action guy, as one reviewer said, you know, the guy from 24. How do you take that, and how do you mix that with this weird science and horror?
Well, partly I kind of look at the way the world's going anyway. I mean, when I was a kid, I was born in the late 50s, grew up in the 60s and 70s. Stuff like cell phones and personal computers and colonization of Mars, which is in the works, and artificial intelligence, all of that was distant science fiction. It was stuff from Star Trek. It was stuff from the Twilight Zone. And now it's not only here, it's old hat. I mean, we've had personal computers for years and the internet for years, and we're living in science fiction. So considering that so many people are growing up with these brand new scientific things coming out all the time, we're kind of conditioned to accept that something bizarre is going to happen, and something bizarre tends to happen all the time. And we keep pushing back the boundaries of what we know about science. So standing on that, I'm able to then go push it further still and because 9/10 of the story is based on cutting edge science that, you know, is in the newspapers and so on, that last tenth, that's the bizarre, is easier to take because it's seeded in stuff that we can already accept. So it's kind of like there's actually a con man saying, use 9 truths to sell 1 lie. And essentially that works for fiction. The more truth you have, the easier it is to sell the fictional elements of it.
And that's true, because now you pretty much just described the basis of the X-Files.
Yes, exactly.
They manage to take the X-Files further and further and further out there by basing it on a combination of a pair of compelling characters.
Right.
And as you said, adding in just enough science and real world thriller aspects, the FBI and, you know, crime and everything else. And then they also had the two plot lines where they had the alien plot line and then they had the standalones where, you know, like
right.
I believed Fluke Man could be living in the sewer system.
If they found Fluke Man, it wouldn't surprise me. I'd be like, yeah, okay, I could see it.
Okay,
That's actually what makes things like the X-Files and the Joe Ledger series and James Rollins' Sigma Force series and a few others, it makes them so palatable because we keep finding new weird stuff all the time. And we've now gotten to the point where, you know, if somebody were to tell me that they found an alien spacecraft somewhere, you know, like a real one, not mm-hmm. I mean, one that you could actually go and look at and touch, my reaction would be, cool. It wouldn't be, no, that's impossible. It would be cool because I would believe that, you know, sure, it's inevitable. That's that kind of a reaction. And it makes everybody part of it. We're all in on the fun and weirdness of it.
Your reaction would be, who do I know that could get me a tour? That would be your reaction.
I know who to call.
And that's another one too. How much of your research is actually based in that kind of, like, you know, you can pick up a phone and call somebody and ask them a question.
A lot of it. That's one of the fun things about this. If I'm doing research on something, say I want to do research on a bioweapon. I mean, like a really cutting edge bioweapon. I've got like 10 or 12 people I can make a phone call to or drop an email to, who will in fact give me information. Great example, in Dogs of War, I wanted to come up with a way to weaponize rabies and use whooping cough, pertussis, as a delivery system for it. And, you know, luckily nature, Mother Nature can't do that, but a bioweapons thing, it's conceivable. So I contacted mm-hmm. John Samar, who is a doctor of infectious diseases of note. And I use him, and my buddy Scott Sigler uses him for his novels. And I said, John, this is what I need. How possible is it? And he writes back, says, oh, it could be done if, and then he gives me a whole bunch of data. And then I say, well, how would I explain that to, say, a field operator, a special ops guy who's not a scientist? And he gives it to me in those words. So I can mm-hmm. actually contact that guy. I have a submarine guy I can contact, the Admiral of the Pacific Submarine Force. I have people in nuclear power. I've got the experts in drones and law enforcement and the military. So, because they all, a lot of them read this stuff. So getting them to talk about it is a piece of cake. And it's fun too, because what happens is during these interviews, when I ask them questions, I not only ask them the stuff that I want to know, I ask them, what don't I know enough to ask you?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we all have assumptions about stuff. And then they tell me the stuff that's so new, so cutting edge, it hasn't made it out to the public yet. And that allows me to put stuff in there that is, you know, literally the cutting edge of this science. It makes it so much fun to research and to write.
Well, that's similar. I mean, how many times was Tom Clancy accused of, you know, like having a leak or a bug inside the Pentagon?
Yeah.
And it was just a combination of he knew people, he knew how to ask the right question, and then he also knew how to make assumptions based on what was given him.
That's a big part of what we do. I mean, we're in the what if game. And, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of us, you know, read a tremendous amount about, like, I read science journals and political journals and so on. And I am conditioned to ask, what if? And I also, you know, my background was not fiction. I did 25 years as a magazine feature writer. I was trained to be a reporter. So I'm used to asking questions and getting, you know, the hook, the more interesting angle on it. So I just took that and applied it to fiction. And as a result, I'm able to ask the questions that get me the kind of information that helps me build a book. And I'm conditioned now to think of all the worst possible outcomes of things. And that's where fiction is.
And that's fabulous. And you also do, my friend agent Janet Reed, she was talking about what she looks for in both what she's looking for as an agent and what she likes to read is the tang of authenticity.
Yeah.
That even if something isn't 100% dead on, you still convince me it is.
That's the trick. And it takes, you know, it takes some skill to be able to figure that out, how to do that. Because you don't want it to, you know, suddenly to get to a part and a red light goes off and you realize, oh, that's ridiculous. You want them to not know where the truth ends and the fiction starts. You want that to be completely blurred. And it's a fun challenge as a writer to be able to get into that moment, to find out, you know, and craft the scenes that are going to be very hard. You want them to go to Google and have to try to figure it out.
Yes, definitely. And when you're not, you know, saving and simultaneously destroying the world with Joe Ledger, you're also up to your elbows being an anthology editor. And the most recent one that came out is Knights of the Living Dead with George Romero.
Yeah, that was a dream project of mine for a long time. My background with you know, Night of the Living Dead and George Romero, when I was 10 years old, I snuck into the movie theater with a buddy of mine to see the world premiere of Night of the Living Dead, October 2nd, 1968. And, you know, I've been there from the beginning, and I loved the concept of the living dead. I love all the variations, and there's 1,000 variations on it. So now that I'm to the point where I can make this kind of phone call, I decided to get George on the phone and ask if he'd be interested in allowing me to do an anthology of stories set in the 48 hours around that movie. And he went me one better, and he said he not only does he have give his blessing, he wanted to co-edit it with me, and he wanted to write a story for it, and to ask me to write a story that connected one of my novels to Night of the Living Dead, because, you know, he regards that one book, Dead of Night, as the book that tells the backstory of his movie. So that was a huge honor, and we had a lot of fun on that book.
And I'm sure he did too, and he passed away 5 days after publication, right? Am I correct?
Yeah, in fact, I was doing a signing at Mysterious Galaxy Bookstore in San Diego with my friend Dana Fredzer. She had a book out the same day, and we were talking about Romero, and I was telling, you know, about my connection with him and the process of editing the book with him, and the bookstore manager came over and told me that she just heard that George Romero had passed, and I was crushed. I mean, he and I had become pretty good friends, and plus he was a hero of mine. And it was crushing. But at the same time, there was a room full of people there drawn to, you know, that event because of their love of Night of the Living Dead. So as a group, we were able to kind of share a lot of memories back and forth and talk about George. So it was a celebration of his life as well as, you know, us all getting the news that he had passed.
Well, and also what you and the other writers in the anthology gave him in his final illness, that seeing that he isn't just a, you know, 99-cent in the DVD bin type of thing from, you know, 1968, that it's still the, you know, a couple of generations of writers since then are still revere him. So that's a gift you gave him too in that final illness of his.
It was really an honor to work with him, and also the other writers. I mean, George and I came up with a list of who would be involved in it. Everyone said yes. All of us who write, you know, with Night of the Living Dead type of stuff, zombies or something similar, owe a lot of our career to George. I mean, there wouldn't be a Walking Dead.
Yes.
It wouldn't be World War Z. There wouldn't be Game of Thrones because, you know, the
You're
army
right.
of the whites, they're zombies. So all of this stuff would not exist if it wasn't for George. And even though he doesn't always get the credit, and even though sometimes the younger generation only know World War Z or Walking Dead or something, and they don't know where it came from, it all started with George. And also, even things like 28 Days Later, which are infected movies, not technically zombies, they're outgrowths of a movie he did called The Crazies, which are, you know, the homicidal infected storyline. So he created
True.
Both versions of that. George was massively influential.
He basically was the father of a genre. And
Absolutely.
there are definitely worse things to have as basically the summation of your life and your career is being the creator of a genre. And then watching writers like you know, take it and meld it with thrillers. I love The Walking Dead. I even when it gets a little soap opera-ish, I still fundamentally love it because I wrote something about, you know, why zombies, why we're drawn to them. And I just said, it's the disaster that keeps on giving. Every day is a new apocalypse.
It is. And one of the things that we talk about with things like Walking Dead and so on, the zombies since they don't have a personality, they don't intrude on the drama, the human drama. Once they are introduced, they represent a massive event that changes the lives of every character, forces them to reevaluate who they are and to you know, explore what life is like without the affectation that people usually carry around with them. So and usually once introduced, the zombies then kind of fade to the background, and the story just is a drama about people in crisis. There's no end to the amount of good original storytelling you can tell about people in crisis. So the genre will never truly get old.
And that's what I've said too. It's in some other post-APOC literature, it's like once the bomb has gone off, the bomb has gone off. Once the giant killer wave has swept over the land, the giant killer wave is gone. But the zombies just keep right on coming. It's a new apocalypse every day.
Yeah, every
and
time the characters
like
get
said,
complacent, they reintroduce the zombies to show that there is no stability. This is still a problem you have to figure out.
And as you said, that just means that the well never goes dry on the the stories and the stories and the situations. And is that anthology been well received?
It's been very well received. It's gotten a lot of good press, a lot of support in reviews. The reviews have been across the board really, really good. And also just the fans are telling me how much it means to them to have a story, to read zombie stories that have George Romero's approval on them, that, you know,
yes.
they're part of what Romero considers his world. And that elevates the stories that my contributors wrote to a different level, because they're not just zombie stories. They're zombie stories written for George about George's world. And that makes it special.
No pressure there.
Yeah, no pressure there. I tell you, though, it's funny. As much as that would feel intimidating, everybody I talked to who wanted to be involved in this just jumped at it. And we had to turn away something like 200 other writers who heard about the project and asked if they could be involved.
Oh, I can imagine.
There's a lot of enthusiasm.
Do you see the possibility of another edition?
It's probably likely. You know, of course, the book's only been out for like a month and a half. So, you know, once the first quarter returns come in, the publisher and I will have a conversation about whether we do another volume. And there are a lot of people who want to be involved, including some of the folks who were in the first one who want to come back again. But more than likely, if I did a second volume, I'd try to have an all original lineup of other people, maybe even Robert Kirkman from Walking Dead. Max Brooks may want to do something. Because we've talked about it, and there's a lot of people out there who have important and interesting things to say in terms of writing zombie fiction.
And I can understand, excuse me, I can understand that sensation. I have a story in an anthology that should be coming out within the next month or so, which are stories that are inspired on the music of Johnny Cash.
Outstanding.
And you felt that same thing. It's taking this, you know, music like you're talking about sneaking in to see Night of the Living Dead. You know, that's what my dad had on the record player when I was growing up. And then
nice.
And then to be taking one of these songs and interpreting it into a vigilante story. I did Man in Black. And then seeing what all the other writers did too. And that was another one. Talk about not having any problem finding writers to fill it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's anthologies often have a draw like that, where it allows us to step into that world for a bit and play in it without having to try to take ownership of it away from the person who created it, but to honor that person, to add to the world.
And one thing with George Romero's is the baseline of the world is built.
Uh-huh.
So now you just get to go in and play.
You do. But here's one thing about Night of the Living Dead, and this is something that, mm-hmm. that a lot of folks don't get. Most people think that when George did the first movie, that the rules, so to speak, for what a zombie is, were set in that movie and never varied. He varied them in every one of his films. So
yes.
He actually allowed for interpretation and for new thought to come into it. The way he described it to me when we were talking on the phone the first time is he said that if people come up with something that's a little different than his, that's because the events we saw in Night of the Living Dead were largely related by unreliable narrators. Everybody was in shock and panic, so you can't necessarily trust what anyone says. So, of course,
makes
there
sense.
Are other you know, impressions and interpretations of the disaster. And so by extension, things like The Walking Dead, you know, or my Dead of Night novel, for example, could exist in that world because they're different parts of the crisis happening in different places. And that makes it original to each place. So George was very inclusive about that. And I've been involved in a few other anthologies that are themed like that. Like I just did one for Mike Mignola's Hellboy character.
Oh my goodness.
And I, you know, I was able to do something for that. I did a Wizard of Oz story. I did a John Carter of Mars story. I actually did a Planet of the Apes story recently. And it's fun to be able to go in there. I did a Sookie Stackhouse story for Charlene Harris, who created True Blood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to go in and by invitation, go in and play in their worlds and get to play with their toys a little bit. And it's kind of like being a professional fanboy.
Definitely. Well, I'm interested, too, in this one. What is this series of the X-Files origins about?
Well, that was a project that I cooked up after having edited several X-Files anthologies for IDW. We had gotten permission from Chris Carter, the creator of X-Files, to do some anthologies. And IDW is a publishing company here in San Diego. And the CEO, Ted Adams, and I had cooked up the idea of the X-Files anthologies. And while we were doing it, I thought it would be fun if we could do some stories that kind of focused on what happened to Mulder and Scully when they were teenagers, not together because they didn't meet as teenagers, but the forces that were at work in their lives as kids. I wanted to do an anthology of teen stories, but that didn't sell at the time. But I got permission mm-hmm. from Chris to be able to take the idea and shop it as novels. And I talked to my friend Cammie Garcia, who was the co-author of Beautiful Creatures. And she had written a single teen Mulder story for the second anthology and did such a great job on it. And I said, well, why don't we just take that and run with it? So we pitched the idea to Macmillan, and she would write the young teenage Mulder story, and I would write the young Dana Scully story. And the books came out in January. Hers is Agent of Chaos, and mine is Devil's Advocate. And we had a tremendous amount of fun. We're not sure if it was really intended to be a series so much as just those two books. We may come back mm-hmm. and do more. Cammie's very busy, and so am I. But we had so much fun. And they're, you know, officially sanctioned by both Chris Carter and Fox. So they're actually the official backstories now of those characters.
Wow, that in particular is superb, because particularly with Dana, we only got the slightest little hints. I mean, a fair amount of Mulder's story was examined because of his sister Samantha, but very little of Dana. You know, at the towards the end of the series, there was some with her family and the baby and that sort of thing, but we never really knew who she was growing up.
Yeah, and some of those things were intriguing because it was, you know, we knew from some of the episodes that she has a touch of psychic ability. You know, like she sees her father when he dies and a couple other things, and they allude to the fact that she used to have those visions, but only of seeing dead people, and that she used to believe and got over it or got past it, you know. So when I decided to write Devil's Advocate, I wanted to explore that. If she used to believe, why did she stop believing? And what happened while she still believed? What was going on during that time? And that's what Devil's Advocate's about. She goes from having visions and believing in the paranormal to becoming the hard-nosed, somewhat inflexible scientist she became, especially in the earlier parts of the series.
That's great. I can't wait to read that one. And what other? Do you have any other anthologies on deck right now?
Oh, boy. I had a couple. Actually, I think I had three come out this year so far. Knights of the Living Dead's most recent. But just before that, we had two fun ones. One is Aliens Bug Hunt, which is a story set in the world of the Aliens movie franchise. And I edited that one for Titan, and that was a whole bunch of fun because I'm a big fan of those movies. And the other one was something I did with Michael Ventrella, who's a buddy of mine from Pennsylvania when I used to live there, called Baker Street Irregulars. And it's all stories essentially about Holmes and Watson, except no version of the story includes two male characters. So the characters could be women, they could be aliens, they could be animals, they could be anything. The concept of a, you know, high-functioning sociopath with superb observational powers and his very credulous and supportive but not quite as brilliant friend make a great model for storytelling. So everybody involved in it went in and told a different kind of story using that as a setup. And we got some great stories in there. And we're just in the near the ending of an end part of editing the second volume.
Oh, cool.
Which I think it'll be called
Do you have any idea when it may drop?
Boy, you think I would know that offhand? Got so many projects juggling, I don't know. But my guess is it's going to be end of the year or early next.
That is great. And I know Mike is working on, I guess, his book, the nonfiction book on the band The Monkees is going to be coming out real soon. And I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Mike is one of those writers who's going to break. Mike's going to break big. He's got a lot of talent, a lot of heart, and a lot of people like him. So I think there's going to be a lot of support for when his solo book comes out.
Oh, I'm a big fan of Mike. I consider him to be a friend. I've guest posted on his blog a couple of times about different legal issues, and it's always interesting.
Yeah, and for me, it's particularly fun to work with somebody who I put in the category of good guy. And I try to only work with people that I consider to be in that good guy category. And Mike's definitely one of the good guys.
And we've swapped a few defense attorney stories to be sure as well. That's always
nice.
Talk about another place that's an endless well of storytelling.
See, now I'm getting another anthology idea.
Ooh. For example, I remember sitting in a courtroom and working on my file and having the prosecutor say, with no irony whatsoever, "And Your Honor, that is when the defendant set the moth on fire."
That's the kind of opening line you really want to build a story around.
Yeah, what happened in real life is he burned the barn down, but in that type of thing, and just in that delivery, in that courtroom delivery, and I had to put my file over my face so I didn't get myself a contempt citation because I was laughing so hard. So is the law is full of those type of great moments. Now we were talking in the green room about you have a standalone coming out soon. Glimpse?
Yeah, Glimpse is a bit of a departure for me. It's coming out March 27th, I believe, from St. Martin's Griffin. I rarely do standalones. I love doing series books, but this one is one of those ideas that I just wanted to write the story. It's not a typically heroic sort of character. The main character is a 26-year-old woman. She's an ex-junkie. When she was 16, she got pregnant with a guy with a slightly older guy. He was 18, but he was going off to fight in Afghanistan, where he died. And so he never got to see the baby. Her mother made her give the baby up. Now we roll forward 10 years later. She's been clean from being a drug addict for years. She was a crack addict for years. And she's starting to get visions of this baby, whose kid's actually now 10. And he's in really bad trouble. And she gets these little glimpses from a crack in a pair of reading glasses that let her see that something very bad is happening to her kid. And bad things will happen to all of us if she doesn't save that kid. So it's a different kind of story for me. It's not quite horror. It's not quite suspense. It's not quite fantasy. It's a little bit of everything. And I wrote it, you know, sometimes when you write a book, especially if you've been writing for a while, sometimes you write a book that you think, okay, this is the one that's so far out there, my career is over when my editor sees this. You know, it's that kind of thing. You know, you send emails to your writer friends and you tell them, this is, you know, that's it, I'm done. Forgetting that they have sent you similar emails on projects in the past too. And then, you know, I'm like biting my nails and sweating it while my editor's reading it. And usually it takes him a week or two to get back to me with a book. 3 days, you know, later, he gets back to me and says, I took off work to sit home and read this thing. It's the best thing you've ever written. I think it's going to be a bestseller. You know, I love this book. And I'm like, wait, did you call the right number? and my agent, my literary agent and my film agent had the same reaction. And now we have, you know, we're starting to get interest from some TV studios and producers about it, even though the book's not actually out yet. So sometimes you can take a risk. It really pays off.
I think it sounds fascinating. And again, you've almost called back a little bit to your Dana Scully character of, you know, these things that happened to her when she was young, the baby, you know, gave the baby up to give it a better life. But now there's something that's drawing them back together. So I think I don't think it was that out there at all. I think you nailed it and sounds like you're going to hit it out of the park.
Well, I had a lot of fun writing it, even though I didn't think while writing it that it was going to be the success at least the critical success that it's apparently destined, you know, heading for. I really wrote the book I wanted to read. And that's kind of the thing for me. I've got to write something that I would go out of my way to read. It was advice I got when I was a kid. I was fortunate enough to get to know Ray Bradbury and Richard Matheson as a kid. And their advice to me was only write the things that not only would you read, but that you would go out of your way to read. And,
well, there's
that's
a pair
the book
of mentor. There's a pair of mentors for you. That's amazing.
Boy. Yeah, I was very fortunate. And, my editor sent the book out, like a rough cut of the book out to some people just to see if he kind of wanted to know whether his judgment on it was correct. So we sent it out to some other people. And, you know, we got like killer blurbs from like Clive Barker, Sherlyn Kenyon, Scott Smith, who wrote The Ruins, Charlene Harris, James Rollins. You know, I mean, like everyone just hit us with tremendous support for this, even though it was a raw, rough cut of the book. Heather Graham, you know, loved it. And, you know, every time my editor would call me up and say, you know, we got another endorsement, I'm like, really? So sometimes you don't know what you have, but if you're passionate about it as a writer, you've got to go do it. And that's what happened with that.
Well, and as you said, too, you kind of had this mindset of, hey, I've had a good career. I've done some good things.
Yeah.
Let's try something different.
Yeah.
And you've obviously got the skill to carry it off. And it's a hell of a story. I mean, I've seen the cover art. The cover art is beautiful.
Yeah, they did a great job with the cover.
And it sounds like it's going to be very amazing. So that's coming out in March of 2018, and it's called Glimpse.
Yeah, March 27, Glimpse. And it's actually, they have it up for pre-order now too. And I'm just really excited to, I can't wait to find out who they're going to get to do the audiobook. I put in some recommendations, which I unfortunately can't mention, and I hope they get the actress I want to not only do the audiobook is also who I, in my dream casting, would play the role, but I'm not supposed to mention the name yet, just in case.
Hopefully we'll find out. I love audiobooks. I'm a huge fan of them. I work at home. I run a little mail order business, and I've always got an audiobook going when I'm working, when I'm actually on my feet. Have you been happy with your narrators? You think they do a good job in your stories?
I'm very, very happy with my narrators. I've got a couple that I use for different projects. And originally I didn't have any say in this. Now I get more say. You know, it's one of the advantages of being successful is they actually start listening to you. And mind you, doesn't mean I'm always right in who I recommend, but the one guy that I've been right with across the board is Ray Porter. He does the Joe Ledger books. He's done my Sam Hunter Werewolf Private Investigator short stories. He's done a couple of collections of my short fiction. And also one of my standalone novels that's based on a board game called Ghostwalkers. And every time he does a story, it's like he's a chameleon. He becomes different people. He's amazing. So he's my go-to guy.
That's great. That makes me want to check the series out, because I'll go through after I've read a series, and I'll go listen to it again on audio if they've got the right narrator.
I do the same thing.
Yeah. My friend Joe Clifford, he's got a great narrator on his. Mark Graney, he has a guy named Jay Snyder does the Court Gentry books, and he is Court Gentry. You know,
exactly.
He just nails it.
That's one of the things. When you get the right narrator, they take ownership of the character, and they become that character. And what happens is, like with Ray Porter, he's when I write the next, you know, each Joe Ledger book now, I hear his voice in my head.
Yes.
So now, mind you, at the same time, because Ray's now become a friend of mine, like he'll actually show up at some of my book launches and do readings for me. When I'm writing those books, not only do I hear his voice in my head, I also try to trip him up so that he has to have a little fun with it, but it always backfires on me. Good, a couple examples. When I was doing Killswitch, which has the, you know, the Cthulhu stuff in it, I had the Cthulhu prayer, which is actually unpronounceable. You know, it's in this language of these elder gods. Turns out Ray is one of the few people who actually is considered an authority on pronouncing Cthulhu, right? How the heck would anyone be, you know? Yeah, so it just happened to be, and I didn't know that about Ray, you know. Another time, I was doing this book, Ghostwalkers, and I had one of the characters, it was set in the Old West, I had one of the characters speaking Lakota Sioux. And I figured, that's really going to mess with Ray, because he would probably have to call the reservation. So, turns out, he speaks Sioux. Nobody speaks Sioux.
Of course he does. Of course he does.
He speaks Sioux, you know. So, Ray and I have a lot of fun with this. I do get him sometimes with character names. So he has to occasionally do some research to pronounce a particular character, but he more often than not will know how to do it right the first time. And he does cold reads, which is weird. Instead of reading the book first, he sits down and records it as he's reading it for the first time.
Wow.
That's really gutsy. That's a whole level of skill far beyond what I could ever do. And I
with the character... The character names, that reminds me of an anecdote from Stephen King where he will occasionally read his own short stories for the audio version. And when he was rehearsing one of them, he went back and changed one of the characters' names to, like, Smith. because he got tired of saying whatever the name was he'd originally had in it. And what you were saying about your narrator is Mark Graney said the same thing. He said he would call up Jay and go, "I'm really sorry, this new book's got like 16 different accents in it." And he's like, "Yeah, man, you know, another day at the office type of thing."
Yeah.
We
that's by the way is why writers should rarely read their own work on audiobooks, and some prefer. Occasionally they can do it right, like John Le Carre is fantastic. But an actor is an actor, professional actor, for a reason.
Yes.
So I yield to that level of skill.
It is one of those unsung professions that doesn't get its due, because there's nothing more amazing than a good audiobook narrator. And hopefully with, say, the advent of like Audible and the kind of on-demand audiobooks, that will become more, you know, more prevalent, because one of the things in Audible is you can rate the narrator.
Right. And actually, one of my narrators won an award for one of the X-Files books, Bronson Pinchot, who was a TV comedian actor who's now one of the top audiobook readers, won an award for, reading my X-Files novels, X-Files anthologies, rather.
That's superb. And as you said, they truly are actors. They're not readers. They're not narrators. They're not voiceover guys. They're actors.
Yes.
Once a year, I go back and I listen to the entire Harry Potter series on audio.
Oh, Jim Dale or Stephen Fry?
I've heard them both. I have the complete Jim Dale set, and I have a few of the Stephen Fry's because they're harder to get. But even Jim Dale, there's just something about hearing it with the proper accent and the proper, you know, the way that the little colloquialisms and everything else come through is just brilliant.
I totally agree. I'm a huge Jim Dale fan. I also love his version of Christmas Carol. But Stephen Fry did the complete Sherlock Holmes and was absolutely brilliant in that. So sometimes you have to match the right reader to the right material. And Stephen Fry is perfect for Holmes. Jim Dale,
yes,
as far as I'm concerned, owns Harry Potter. He is the voice in my head for Harry Potter.
And even other writers like John Grisham. I actually prefer his books in audio because they always get somebody with a Honey and Magnolia Southern accent to narrate it.
Yeah.
And it's just better. It's just better that way.
Totally agree.
So now I'm curious about the Joe Ledger books on audio. Next time I have an Audible credit come up, I'm going to have to go check them out.
they're great. And also, he's not only done the audio, the novels, he's also done the Joe Ledger Special Ops short story collection. So, he's great. Ray Porter just does a fantastic job. And it sounds narcissistic to say you like listening to your own audiobooks, but his performance is so good that it allows me to hear them in a different way than I had in my head when I was writing them. So they become fresh and entertaining for me.
Well, and as you said, you actually now you hear Joe Ledger in his voice and the cadence and the rhythm and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found that influences at all how you write, how Joe talks?
Some of how Joe talks, but more it influences Joe's boss, Mr. Church, because I originally had him with a certain accent and Ray gave him kind of a New England Kennedy type accent. And now that absolutely changes the way in which the character responds to things as I'm writing it. Because I can see him now more as that New Englander with that dry sense of humor, the sarcasm that's not quite an insult, that a New Englander seems to be able to do so well, and it's wonderful. So yeah, I definitely hear the way he does certain characters, and it influences how I write those characters.
Oh, that's awesome! I hadn't even thought about that. So, to call back to something you talked about earlier, you said how much you enjoy writing series.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a question I always ask of a series writer: if someone wanted to jump into Joe Ledger, where's a good point?
Really, there's a couple of good entry points. Even though there is kind of a through line to all the books in terms of character development, certain books were deliberately written as open doors for people to jump in. Patient Zero being the first. Assassin's Code, the fourth novel, is a great entry point. Extinction Machine is probably the most well-regarded entry point. It's also the one that the book that if this does actually go to TV, that's the book they're thinking of starting with. What the producers are talking about.
So which number is Extinction Machine?
Extinction Machine is 5.
Okay.
I believe. And then also Dogs of War, the latest one, was written because it kind of the team that's involved in it goes through a lot of stuff, and with Dogs of War they get a nice fresh start, so to speak. You know, it's the rebuilding of their team. So it was intended for people to be able to jump in at that point.
So is it a start of like a new arc, or like you said, just a after the, you know, run in with an elder god?
Well, it's really not so much a start of an arc, but a step closer to each book being completely standalone. I mean, they're like James Bond in a way, in that, you know, if you actually read the original James Bond stories, there was a character arc that, you know, character growth arc that he went through. But you can really pick up any James Bond book and jump in. This is, you know, that's Joe Ledger's very much like that. You can actually start anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The first three books are probably harder to start in the middle of, because there's a grief thing that he goes through in those three books that has a resolution. But really, after that, there's anywhere you want to jump in, you can jump in. Whatever you need to know about other characters or previous stories, you're told in a very quick flashback way that doesn't bog down the story. And, you know, my intention is to not preclude people who want to jump in.
Yeah, because once you start looking at something that's got, you know, 9-10 books in the series, it gets a little daunting. Or you may come across a book, you may get it as a gift, you may, you know, get it, it may suddenly be on sale randomly. And then if you like it, obviously, it's awesome to go back to the beginning and start over, but that could also take a while, depending on how much you read. So that's cool that you're not making them dependent on, they're not episodic.
Yeah, and to that end, and this is, I'm just going to be a little vague here, but there's a very big possibility that Joe Ledger 11 might be a new kind of Joe Ledger 1. I'm going to be making a substantial change in the series with what book 11 will be. Working title is called Enigma, and I won't tell you any more about it. But that is intended to not only kind of reboot the series, or not reboot, because we're not changing the mythology. It's a fresh start that is going to be very, very much open to not only new readers, but international readers. And that's all I can say about that right now. Yeah.
So, gang, you heard it here on the Blue Plate Special, Joe Ledger 11. We've got something interesting going on here. That is fantastic.
Though.
And you said, well, so you're not exactly sure when number 10 may be out because Glimpse took its slot.
Yeah. So most likely, number 10, which is known as Deep Silence, will most likely be out around this time next year, or possibly the fall of next year. So it won't be a spring book, because we're, you know, really focusing on the release of Glimpse as my spring novel from that publisher, from St. Martin's Griffin.
And I want to say I thoroughly enjoy the little ad hoc contest that you run for naming characters, et cetera. That's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun for me too, and it proves how deeply weird my readers are and how much I appreciate that.
Well, yeah. We appreciate you as well. I haven't made the cut yet, but I keep coming back and swinging every single time because of how much fun it is.
And I'm surprised at how many entries we get. I mean, one of the first contests we ran was for the third Joe Ledger book, when Joe got his, and I had a contest to pick the breed of the dog and a name. I was kind of hoping for, you know, 20, 30, 40 suggestions. We got 12,000 suggestions.
Okay,
yeah,
that's funny.
I actually got a couple of retired canine cops to go through them and make the picks for me. And I, by the way, I don't always make the pick. I often get people to pick for me, so I'm not biased toward any of my friends on social media. But that one, 12,000 entries. And the weird thing is that dog, fictional dog, gets fan mail.
Well, yeah. I have a dog in my series as well, and I've been told to A, nothing had better ever happen to that dog.
Oh, I am not brave enough to kill, to do any lasting damage to ghosts. No.
And B, they want to know how Simon is doing. So I totally understand that. Social media. You maintain a very open, friendly social media. Do you enjoy it?
I do. I actually believe the social part of social media. It's I don't use it just to promote my stuff. I actually enjoy connecting with people, and I set my timer for 50 minutes. So 50 minutes into each writing hour, I do 10 minutes of social media. So I'm connecting in all day long, and really really enjoying the connection. I've made serious friends, lasting friendships through social media, and it's allowed me to also talk books and movies and other pop culture things with people all over the world. So I'm a real fan of social media in its purest form, which is, a society of people communicating.
That's it. I've said it's one of the things that lets me, live in a really small town in the middle of nowhere, which I don't necessarily mind, but it gives me that reach, that tribe.
Sure.
That's always there. So I completely agree on that. And you'd also mentioned too, there's a Joe Ledger anthology coming up.
There is that Joe Ledger Unstoppable. I co-edited with Brian Thomas Schmidt, and it comes out Halloween Day. And we have stories from some really top-notch writers. We have Weston Oakes, Scott Sigler, Shauna McGuire, Larry Correa, Keith DeCandido, John McGoran, James A. Moore, Steve Alton, and tons of others. We have a lot of really great writers, friends of mine in the industry, which is a kind of a catchphrase from the Joe Ledger books. These are my friends in the industry, and I invited them to come in and play, and they had a lot of fun, and we got some fantastic stories. So I'm really, really happy.
Is there a theme to it, or is it just the Joe, a day in the life of Joe Ledger world?
It's that. I mean, some people write Joe Ledger stories, and with the standard setup of weird science and special ops. Somebody wrote a story about ghosts. Somebody wrote a story that features Rudy, Joe's best friend. So people took different entry points into it. There's a story about Joe Ledger as a teenager, shortly after the trauma that kind of formed his life. And everyone brought their own game. And the thing that I liked most about it, nobody was trying to write a pastiche. Nobody was trying to write a Jonathan Mayberry Joe Ledger story.
Mm-hmm.
They brought their own game, their own skill set, their own style, and wrote a story about those same characters, which is very entertaining for me as a reader to be able to read stories written by these people. So in their own voice, their own style, and in their own power. So I absolutely am a fan of the stories as well as being an editor. And that's a perfect storm right there. When you edit an anthology and you are a fan of the stories in it.
That's superb. And it shows too, the power of this character in this universe that you've created, that it can inspire these, that incredibly talented writer list you just gave me.
Yeah, I'm very happy about that, and I just want to give one little shout out to something that is not often praised, and that is what are called media tie-in writers. Media tie-in writers are people who write stories in the worlds of other things. Sometimes they novelize movies, sometimes they write original novels set in the world of movies or TV or games, and a lot of them are people. I know some of these people very well. And we play in each other's worlds as well as the bigger licenses like X-Files and so on. So when somebody is writing media tie-in work, they have to not only be knowledgeable about the world, they have to find a passion about it. They have to find often they're fans of it, so they bring the fan enthusiasm, but also first class writing and storytelling capabilities. It's a wonderful mix. And unfortunately, some people seem to think that if you're writing media tie-in stuff, that it's not interesting or not original. And that's not the case at all. There are superbly talented writers out there doing media tie-in work. Chuck Wendig, for example, with his Star Wars
yes.
novels. Superb writing. Yeah, absolutely superb. So
well,
I had
some
of these guys working with me, and I loved it.
That's great, and I love media tie-in books. I loved them when I was a teenager and coming up. I have a pretty decent audio collection of the X-Files books, some of the different X-Files
oh, cool.
novels that were written, et cetera. And I think they're great because, again, it's
yeah.
another one, too. Just an example, too, like Hugh Howey put his worlds of sand and wool into Kindle worlds, which is essentially
mm-hmm.
sanctioned fan fiction. Because
right.
there's no way in the world Hugh Howey is going to be able to write enough to keep up with his fans. They're rabid.
Yep.
And what it does is it lets people go in and examine and explore around the world in their own right. I've written one in Hugh Howey's World of Sand just for that same reason. I'm fascinated by it. And it gave me my own chance to go in and create that my own set of characters to go in that world. So I agree 100%. Well,
yeah, I mean, my first New York Times bestseller was a media tie-in book. I did the novelization of The Wolfman. And, you know, even though there was a script to work from, a script
mm-hmm.
is not a novel. A script doesn't
no.
give you as much material as you need to fill out an entire novel. And you don't get to see the movie when you write a media tie-in book. You get a script. That's it. So I had to do research and write a gothic novel. And I was proud of it and very happy that it was a bestseller, very happy that it won awards. You know, it was something that it was a piece of writing. It was not just wrapping words around lines in a script. And that's
no.
what media tie-in is all about, of true writing.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for coming on here tonight. I could keep talking to you all night. I hope I can run into
yeah,
you at a conference sometime and continue on.
Yeah, it's been a bunch of fun.
Will you come back when Glimpse comes out? I'd like to hear more about
absolutely.
What's going on. All right.
Yeah, I'll absolutely come back.
I have a couple of little housekeeping announcements I have to make, but I will tell you good night, and I will thank you for coming by, and we'll talk to you again soon. See you around social media.
Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
All right. Good night. And if you enjoyed this broadcast, support was provided by Down and Out Books, celebrating 6 years of award-winning crime fiction. You can check them out at downandoutbooks.com. And I was told, too, that they didn't get 6 Anthony nominations. They got 8 when you add in imprints and their other writers. So congratulations to them, and let's see some wins this year at BoucherCon. And this podcast is owned and copyrighted by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. You can follow the Blue Plate Special on Facebook to keep track of who's on the menu. And I will wish you all a good night, and we'll see you on Friday. Take care.